From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, On the One with Bootsy Collins. As a teenager, he played bass for James Brown. Then he became one of George Clinton's Parliament Funkadelic All-Stars and went on to form his own group, Bootsy's Rubber Band. He has a new Best Of collection and an album of new music. Also today, life with a famous, gifted, troubled mother. We talk with Linda Gray Sexton, the daughter of the late poet Anne Sexton. Linda has written a memoir about her mother. And linguist Jeff Nunberg tells us about his new handheld electronic dictionary. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Iraq has formally told the United Nations Security Council that it is pulling back its troops from the Kuwaiti border. The diplomats say this is a clear signal that Baghdad wants to defuse the situation. NPR's Trevor Rowe reports.
Iraq's ambassador to the United Nations, Nizar Hamdoun, has formally notified the president of the Security Council that Baghdad intends to pull back its forces from the Kuwait border. Washington has repeatedly warned that two elite armored divisions were headed south towards the border, where an additional three divisions were already based. So far, there is no indication that Iraq has actually begun to pull back. However, if true, then it's a clear sign that Baghdad is reconsidering its show of force in the face of a strong response from Washington, which is sending 36,000 troops to the area, as well as a wide array of air power. This is Trevor Rowe in New York.
President Clinton has canceled a political trip to New Jersey because of the concerns over Iraq. The president had planned to attend an anti-crime rally and campaign for Senator Frank Lautenberg. Mr. Clinton is getting a vote of confidence from former President Bush. Mr. Bush says the president is doing the right thing by moving troops to counter Iraqi forces. Mr. Bush came under fire as president for not forcing Iraqi President Saddam Hussein from power at the end of the Gulf War 3 years ago. But he says doing that would have shattered the coalition he built to defeat Baghdad. Secretary of State Warren Christopher held talks in Jerusalem today with Israeli officials. He's looking for ways to break the impasse in peace negotiations with Syria. Christopher also condemned the latest attack by Palestinian extremists. NPR's Paul Miller has more from Jerusalem.
The attack by two gunmen on a busy pedestrian street in the center of Jerusalem took place just a few blocks from the hotel where Christopher was staying. The secretary said the attack was an atrocity and said the enemies of peace had shown their cowardly face. The extremist group Hamas claimed responsibility for the attack, in which two people were killed and several wounded, including an American foreign aid worker, before police killed the two gunmen. Hamas said the attack was in revenge for the deaths of 17 Palestinians in a clash with Israeli police on the Temple Mount in Jerusalem 4 years ago. Christopher called on PLO Chairman Yasser Arafat to condemn the attack and to act to prevent further incidents. I'm Paul Miller in Jerusalem.
Raul Cedras has resigned as Haiti's army chief and says he'll leave the country. His departure clears the way for the return of exiled President Jean-Bertrand d'Aristide. Major General Jean-Claude Dupaval has been named as the new commander of the Haitian military. Dupaval spoke publicly, calling for respect for the Haitian hierarchy and respect for human rights. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are up almost 22 points at 3,819. Trading is heavy. This is NPR. Two American scientists have been awarded the Nobel Prize for Medicine. Alfred Gilman and Martin Rodbell are being honored for helping to explain how cells communicate with each other. The Nobel judges in Sweden say the researchers made a paramount discovery in determining how a certain group of proteins help transmit signals in cells. They also found that an imbalance in the proteins can lead to disease. Gilman now works in the pharmacology department of the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center at Dallas. Rodbell is with the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences in North Carolina. Work has started to build a memorial trail up the ridge where 14 firefighters died this summer while battling a wildfire near Glenwood Springs, Colorado. Mark Roberts reports.
The trail up Storm King Mountain will be about 1 mile long. Once it's complete, visitors will be able to hike from Interstate 70 up a steep hill to a ridge so so they can see where the fire exploded in the dry brush and trees, killing the firefighters. From the ridgetop, hikers will be able to look out at the spot where lightning started the fire. They'll be able to see where smoke jumpers crawled into fire shelters and survived, and where the 14 firefighters who died perished in the flames. Less developed trails will lead to the actual places where the deaths occurred. Markers now stand where the firefighters' bodies were found. Work on the trail is expected to be complete by the end of the month. For National Public Radio, I'm Mark Roberts in Denver.
Denver teachers are on strike. They're seeking better working conditions and a greater role in school governance. This is the first teacher strike there in 25 years. Officials are working to keep classrooms open for the district's 63,000 students. Teachers Union President Leonard Fox estimates that 3,000 of the district's 3,800 teachers are on strike. It's not clear yet how disrupted the classes are. There are no reports of violence. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Bootsy Collins is one of the most celebrated funk bass players. Now he has a new best of record called Back in the Day, and he has his first album of new music in 6 years featuring a new rubber band. From that new album, Blasters of the Universe, this is Funk Express Card. Bootsy Collins learned to play funk as a teenager when he was a sideman in James Brown's band during the Sex Machine era. From there, he teamed up with George Clinton, combining funk with science fiction and psychedelia. Then Collins formed his own group, Bootsy's Rubber Band. He created the stage persona Bootzilla, an outsized name to go with his flashy costumes and monster-sized eyeglasses. Hip-hop groups have paid homage to him by using his records as their rhythm tracks. Well, let's get started with the 1970 recording featuring Bootsy Collins on bass with James Brown's Superbad.
Watch me! Watch me! I got it! Watch me! I got it! Hey! I got something that makes me want to shout. I got something that tells me what it's all about. I got soul and I'm super bad. I got soul and I'm super bad.
Do you remember that first night you performed with James Brown on stage?
Oh, man. You know what? I remember it, but I don't actually remember what happened. I remember playing there, and I remember the people when I walked in, you know, because we were late. I mean, well, the band was late, and the show, the whole show was late. It was pretty incredible because the people were chanting, we want James, we want James. And we was walking through the audience. They was looking at us and saying, there's the band. Let's get them. Let's get them. So it was kind of strange for us, you know. But it all kind of worked out after we got to the stage.
Now, did he have to fly you down because his band walked out?
Yeah. As a matter of fact, they hadn't walked out yet. They were still there when we walked in. And they were our buddies, you know. They were our heroes. And it's like, you know how you do when you cross the strike line, man? It's like, whoa. You know, so we felt really strange because we felt really closer to the band than anything else, you know. And here we are walking in and getting ready to do their gig. We didn't realize that until we got there. We thought we were just coming down to do it. James wanted us to do a gig, you know, with him. We didn't know we was coming in and replacing the old band, you know. It was like, wow, it was a whole new ballgame when we got there.
So did you feel you had to ask permission or apologize?
Pretty much, you know, that was pretty much the feeling, you know, because we really respected these guys, you know. They were Fred Wesley, Maceo, you know, Melvin, the drummer, Clyde. I mean, you know, these were like our idols. And, man, you know, to walk in and do their gig, you know, it was like, wow, who are we, you know?
Well, listen, I went back to James Brown's autobiography to see what he had to say about you.
Yeah. Oh, good.
So he writes, I think Bootsy learned a lot from me. When I met him, he was playing a lot of bass.
Yeah.
The ifs, ands, and the buts.
Yeah, he's right.
I got him to see the importance of the one in funk.
Yeah.
The downbeat at the beginning of every bar.
That's right.
I got him to key in on the dynamic parts of the one.
That's right.
Instead of playing all around it.
Yeah.
Then he could do all of his stuff in the right places after the one.
That's absolutely correct. Yeah, absolutely correct.
No, was it hard to make the adjustment to playing on the one?
No, because I knew he knew something. I mean, you know, you know, and I was there to learn. It wasn't like, you know, this is my party and I'll fly if I want to. I knew it was James's party, you know, and whatever he knew, I wanted to find out because, you know, he just had this, the band was the tightest band in the land and he had this thing going on. We wanted to find out what the heck it was, you know.
Now, had you been playing on the 2 and 4 before?
I started playing on the, with a guitar and I wasn't actually a bass player yet.
Mm-hmm.
So I was learning to play bass, you know, and I wanted to play bass. So it was like all those other ifs, ands, and buts is what I was playing when I picked up the bass, you know. It was like, oh, you mean I got to play on the dominant note? Oh, okay. So it was like all brand new to me, you know, and I just didn't feel like a normal bass player, you know, so... But by James telling me that, it all kind of made sense. And once I started hearing it, you know, what was actually happening when I did that, it was like, oh, and then I could still do this and I could still do that. So it was a groove. It was really a groove.
Now let me play one of the recordings you made with James Brown. Why don't we hear Sex Machine? And do you want to say anything about the rhythm you're playing on this?
That's pretty much the whole rhythm is what I figure I've been doing ever since. When you hear Sex Machine, that's pretty much where I'm at now.
Okay, here we go.
Fellas, I'm ready to get up and do my thing.
Go ahead.
I want to get into it, man, you know.
Go ahead.
Like a sex machine, man.
Yeah.
Moving, doing it, you know.
Yeah.
Can I count it off?
Go ahead.
1, 2, 3, 4. Get up.
Get on up.
Get up.
Get on up.
Stay on the scene.
Get on up.
Like a sex machine.
Get on up.
Get up.
Get on up.
Get up.
Get on up.
Stay on the scene. Machine.
Get on up.
Get up.
Get on up.
Stay on the scene.
Get on up.
I like a sex machine.
Get on up.
Wait a minute. Shake your arm. Then use your palm. Stay on the scene. I like a sex machine. You got to have the feeling. Sure as your bone. Get it together. Right on, right on. Get up.
Get on up.
Get up.
My guest is Bootsy Collins. Now, tell me how your image changed when you started playing with James Brown. What you did on stage, what you wore on stage.
Ooh, that's good. That's good. What I wore on stage. Oh, man. As you know, I may not know, those were the days like in the 60s, getting ready to go into the 70s. But, you know, it was another kind of movement going on. And kids were like coming up front and wearing like bleached jeans and T-shirts and afros and, you know, the granny glasses. And, you know, we was all freaking out. We was having a freaking party, you know. And I don't know. Then here we are. We're playing with James Brown and, you know, we're in the Army now. You know, it's like, whoa, you know. So it's like but it was good for the fact that it kind of brought us off of the street. We were out there doing what everybody else was doing, acting crazy, throwing firebombs and doing everything, you know. So getting with James kind of brought us off of the street. And, you know, I think we kind of realized that. And at the same time, you know, it gave us the opportunity of really doing something that we wanted to do. So, you know, we kind of put everything else in the back seat because this is what we wanted to do. Even though, you know, we wanted to dress crazy. We didn't know how crazy we wanted to dress, but we didn't want to wear suits. You know, we knew that.
So you were wearing matching suits on stage while everybody else was wearing jeans and tie-dyed T-shirts?
Yeah, while this movement was going on, the peace, the love, that was going on. And, you know, here we are, you know, getting stuck with wearing suits and patent leather shoes, you know. And but at that time, you know, it was a start of it, so it was cool, you know. We said, well, we'll eat this because, you know, we definitely you know, want to be with James, you know. So if you want to be with James, that's what you had to do.
So you left the band after just a couple of years.
Yeah.
What was the turning point for you that made you think, it's time now, I'm getting out?
Well, you know, I got all the other bands was coming up wearing the freaky stuff that I said, well, wow, I could have did that 3 years ago, you know. And, it was like that. And then it was like, you just want to do things the way you want to do them on stage. You want to go crazy, you want to freak out, you know, because that's what time it was, you know. And here we were just standing up there being the tightest band in the land, but you know, it was only a certain amount of movement you can do, you know. You couldn't jump out in the audience and freak out and act crazy, you know, like that's what it was going to, you know. And that's what we wanted to do, you know. We just wanted to have a low down, hold down, and you know, drip until you wet type party.
Shortly after you left James Brown, you met George Clinton.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, did you think of him as taking James Brown's music to the next step?
Not really. When I got with George, I wasn't even thinking like that. I was just looking at George more of, this is a way that I can really expound on what I really want to do. Because George had an open door, looseness that I could relate to, because he knew what I was reaching for. And he kind of opened arms and said, okay, if you help me with Parliament Funkadelic, writing songs and doing this and playing in a band, then, you know, one day, you know, at the same time, you can do your band and you can do a solo thing, you know, and we'll be working on that all at the same time.
So, I mean, George Clinton is pretty outrageous on stage. So what did that bring out in you, and what were your first steps on stage toward becoming the different personalities on stage that you became?
Well, George was pretty much what any young kid would need, and that's encouragement that whether the world is saying you're doing something right or cool or not, George said, whatever I was doing, cool. That's all I needed, you know? Because once he said, I already felt it was cool anyway. I didn't really need nobody to tell me that. But for him to say that, and for him to be who he was, and he was the craziest man in the universe, and that's what I wanted to be, you know. So for him to say that, it was like, whoa, man, this is bigger than life, you know. And not only say that, but he gave me the opportunity to do it. And that to me was the step that I needed, you know.
Can you talk a little bit about the stage images, the stage personas you created for yourself?
Well, I've always dreamed of that kind of stuff in school, you know, the twinkle, twinkle, the stars, and reaching for the stars, and one day maybe playing a guitar that's made out of a star and maybe seeing through stars. So, you know, I kind of dreamed of that kind of stuff in school. And when I got with George, I figured that this was the opportune time to make that a reality. And that's when I became in search of people to make the glasses and make the basses. And, you know, we have a star fulfill type thing going on.
Now, just describe the glasses as you first started wearing them, and how'd you get them made for you?
Well, the same people that made Elton John's glasses, Optique Boutique out in California. I think they kind of felt sorry for me. I kind of whimpered in off the street, you know. And, you know, I had this lowly, humble thing going on. And they said, come on in, kid. What you need, you know? I said, well, I need some star glasses. And they kind of laughed at me at first. And I kind of drew them out a little bit. And they said, okay. They said, how much money you got to spend, kid? I said, well, actually none. They laughed at me again, you know. But I think they really did feel sorry for me. And they kind of got me a pair up for about $100. They were prescriptions, too. So they kind of went with me. But the next time I went to get some star glasses, they kind of made me they charged me maybe triple, you know. But it was cool.
When you started wearing those really, really big glasses, were those prescription too?
Yeah. All of them were prescriptions, yeah, definitely.
Well, that must be strange.
Yeah, well, it was pretty good for me because I could really see the audience. See, before then, I couldn't really actually see the audience, what was happening out there. You know, all I could do was hear them, and I knew they were out there, but I couldn't see what the funk was going on. But now I can.
My guest is Bootsy Collins. He has a new Best Of CD called Back in the Day, plus a CD of new music called Blasters of the Universe. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. with Bootsy Collins. After playing bass with James Brown, he teamed up with George Clinton, then formed his own group, Bootsy's Rubber Band. So what were the pressures on you of actually having to manage a band and take care of business, take care of salaries, take care of discipline, make sure people showed up for gigs, and that they were, even if they were high, they were able to perform?
Yeah, it was pretty strange, you know, because I never really, you know, looked at really taking care of it on that level. You know, it was always a ghetto level with me. You know, we always rode around in cars, maybe eight, nine people in the car and equipment, you know. So I never really looked at a serious, you know, having to take care of people. And, you know, I never really felt that, you know, until I actually got with George and we started doing Bootsy's Rubber Band. You know, I never felt that before. So when it hit me, it was like, whoa, you know, because all I was thinking was I was out here to, you know, enjoy people and people to enjoy me, and we're going to have a big old party, you know, and beer to go, you know. So it just didn't happen like that. You know, I started having to take care of this truck and rent, you know, sound gear and making sure everybody was there and, you know, everybody's babies is hungry, and I had to kind of be responsible for everybody, you know, and it was a whole nother ball game. So I don't know. I just had to grow up, you know, a little bit here and there.
Did you hate that aspect of the work?
Yeah, pretty. After a while, I pretty much did, because it took me away from what I actually came out there to do.
Music.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I hated it. You know, I hated it. But at the same time, you know, I was in it. You know, that's why I kind of feel. I feel like I was at the point where Jimmy was at and where Sly Stone was at, and a lot of the people that go through, you know, the stuff that they get to that point, you know, and it's like you don't know what the heck to do because there's no books on it, you know.
What point are you talking about?
That point of what the heck do you do? You know you got to do this, you know, and you got to take care of this and you got to take care of that. But at the same time, you just want to play music, you know. And when you get to that point, you don't know what the heck to do. It's like, wow, what do you do?
So what did you do?
I stopped, you know.
Stopped what?
I just stopped playing music. I just stopped and just everybody thought I was crazy, you know, and I thought I was crazy too, you know, because at that point we was doing stadium dates. I was making like $100,000, you know, per stadium, and could nobody understand why I stopped. You know?
How long did you stop for?
It was probably, let's see, I mean, I would say a good six years before I even thought about messing back with it, you know.
When you got back into performing again, what did you do differently?
It was all a trying. I didn't know what to do differently. I just knew what I didn't want to do. And what I didn't want to do is have all that responsibility and, you know, and don't know what to do with it. That was the hard part.
So what's your plan now for
being out here now?
Yeah.
I'm just going to do what I got to do. And when I come off the stage, you know, that cat stays on the stage, you know. It's just I go back to the farm with the rest of the aliens. You know, and I mean, you know, it's just a way of life. You know, you have to separate it. I never knew that. You know, I always wanted to be Bootsy and Bootzilla. You know, I mean, that was 27 hours a day. It's like Bugs Bunny, man. Don't he get a chance to not be Bugs Bunny? No. You know, so it was a whole new ball game, you know, and I kind of had to come up with ideas of how to do this, how to be on like a light and then turn myself off when I got to be off, you know.
Let me play one of the classic Bootsy records. Why don't I play Bootzilla?
Oh.
And this is one of the tracks reissued on a new Warner collection called Back in the Day, the Best of Bootsy.
Yeah.
Say something about writing and recording this.
Let's see. That was in, I think it was in 78, right? 1978. And we done that at the P-Funk Lab in Detroit. And it was George Clinton, myself. We just kind of went in and winged it. And all of a sudden, the monster was born. The rock star doll baby bubble. Yeah.
This is Bootsy Collins from his new Warner Brothers collection.
Yeah! And at no extra expense comes this remote control unit. Oh yeah, I'm programmable. One heck of a doll, baby bubble. Bootzilla here! Made by the makers of funky things to play with. trademark Funk Attack Incorporated.
Pull my string, I'll dance, I'll sing, I'll pray.
Yeah, but never do the bubble.
That's Bootzilla. You know, I'm wondering what you think about rap performers who've sampled your music on their records. Do you think of it as robbery or as homage?
I think it's more like, I guess you would say they kind of kept the funk alive, you know, because the new kids didn't have a clue about us at first, you know. And then the rappers came on with the, you know, sampling the funk and, you know, getting it out. And I think my hat's is off to them, you know, because they kind of kept it alive. It gave me an opportunity to come back around a second time. And, you know, a lot of people don't get that chance.
Do you think some of the rappers initially heard your records through their parents?
Yeah, definitely. As a matter of fact, a lot of them told me that, you know, and a lot of them would tell me that they wanted to come to the show. Like Ice Cube, he was telling me we did this this live stadium date out in L.A., and he wanted to come to the show. He said he was around 10 years old, and his mama wouldn't let him, you know. And he was wired. I mean, he was really upset about he couldn't make it, you know. But he was telling me about that, and it was like, wow, man. The parents kind of passed the records down. That's kind of where they picked up on it at.
Now, I want to ask you a couple things about your bass. You actually started off playing guitar.
Yeah.
And then you started using bass strings on the guitar.
Yeah.
And that's how you started playing bass. Well, why didn't you get a bass?
Money. I didn't have any money. You know, it was like my mother had bought me this guitar because I had begged her, you know, for years, right, about this one guitar, man. And she finally got it for me, and then I decided that I want to play bass, you know. And you know, it's like, right. Come on, man. It took me all these years to get this guitar, you know. So what it was my brother was, you know, he was like playing guitar, and I wanted to be in, I realized that I wanted to be in a band with him after I got a guitar. So how was I going to be in a band with him playing guitar? And he's the guitar player. So I decided, wow, I got to become the bass player. So that's when that big thing came up with, okay, well, I'll take some bass strings and I'll put them on my guitar and I'll play bass with him. You know, this was my big dream to just play with him.
I think James Brown gave you your first bass.
Yeah, he did. He did. Yeah.
What was it like learning to actually play bass on bass instead of on guitar?
Well, you know, the only difference, I think, was the neck was longer. You know, because the strings were pretty much the same. I had put bass strings on the guitar, so they were pretty much the same. It felt the same, but I think the neck was longer because James had got me this Fender Jazz bass, you know, and it was a long sucker, and it was like, whoa, wow. It was like a Cadillac, you know? Yeah.
Now, one of your new records is dedicated in part to all your friends in the kitchens and jails across the world doing hard time.
Yeah.
The kitchens?
Yeah. When I was, you know, when I was like playing like these big coliseums and big time, everything was going on groovy, great. You know, I don't know. Everybody just kind of related to me out of the kitchens of the Holiday Inns and the Ramadas. And I always went back, signed autographs. And I never forgot that because I used to work in the kitchen myself, you know, when I was coming up, like 11. When I was 11 years old, I was like, I'd go get a job. I suppose I'd been like 16 or 18. I told them I was, you know, 16. I told a little white lie every now and then. And by me being tall, you know, they thought I was like 16 or 18. Yeah, you know, you can have a job. And then they'd take me in there, work me to death, put me under the stoves. I'd be cleaning under the stove. But it was groove, you know, because I finally got me a radio. And that's pretty much what started it all.
And you're dedicated also to people in jails.
Yeah.
A lot of your fans or people you know?
I know, you know. And not only that, like I said, I kind of came up the same way, and everybody around me was going to jail. And the only thing that kept me out of jail was the music. That's what kept me out.
Thank you so much for doing the interview.
Oh, the pleasure is all mine.
Bootsy Collins, he has his first new album in 6 years. It's called Blasters of the Universe, and he has a new best of album called Back in the Day. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Dallas? Yeah! It's about time for Mace to get up and do his thing.
Yeah! Yeah! Yeah!
Yeah! You know, like moving it?
Yeah!
Grooving it?
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders,
where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The poet Anne Sexton took her life by inhaling car fumes in her closed garage. Her suicide fed her cult status. Coming up, we talk with Sexton's daughter about what it was like to grow up with a mother who was very talented but very troubled. Linda Gray Sexton has written a memoir about her relationship with her mother called Searching for Mercy Street. Also, looking up a word has never been so easy. Linguist Jeff Nunberg tells us about his new electronic dictionary. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Haitian Army General Raul Cedras has given up power and says he'll leave the country. The White House has responded positively to this. UPI's Carol Van Dam has this report.
A senior administration official says Cedras's resignation was an important part of the U.S. purpose in Haiti. We've been saying for the last few weeks that it would happen, the official says, adding, at the same time, there's lots of work to be done. The official says the U.S. mission does not simply end at this point, with the U.S. turning its attention elsewhere. Clearly, the official went on, this is a very important step. The top official largely attributes Cedras's imminent departure to the 19,000 American troops in Haiti, adding, they've done an excellent job. Asked if there were any clues as to where Cedras is going, the official said that's being worked out. He did not elaborate. Cedras's resignation paves the way for the return of exiled Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. Carol Van Dam, The White House.
President Clinton will speak to the nation this evening at 8 Eastern Time and 5 Pacific Time. He will discuss the U.S. mission in Haiti and the situation in Iraq. Baghdad says it has acted to withdraw the troops from near the Kuwaiti border, but U.N. Ambassador Madeleine Albright says she is skeptical of this claim, and the Pentagon has not confirmed that this has actually started to happen yet. In the meantime, defense officials say they are continuing their U.S. troop deployment in the Persian Gulf region. An African bishop has made a controversial appeal for women to be made lay cardinals within the Catholic Church. His proposal came during a Vatican Synod on Religious Life, which has brought together hundreds of nuns and priests. Francis Kennedy reports from Rome.
Bishop Ernest Kombo, a Jesuit from the Congo, urged that women who form an important part of the consecrated life be given positions of responsibility in the hierarchy. His proposal that they be made lay cardinals was the most radical heard at the synod so far and reflects growing pressure for a greater role for women. Cardinals are appointed by the Pope from the upper ranks of the priests, but there are precedents for them being appointed from outside the priesthood. The thorny issue of women priests is not on the agenda at the month-long synod, but the nuns and women's groups who are attending have been pushing for greater female participation in decision-making. For National Public Radio, I'm Frances Kennedy in Rome.
Swiss police say the body of the mastermind of a cult is among the 48 that were found dead last week. Investigators say Joseph DiMembro has been positively identified as one of the bodies found in a burned-out chalet. There is still no word on the fate of a second cult leader, Luc Jure. The investigation is also being carried on in Canada, Australia, and Europe. On Wall Street, stock prices closed higher today. The Dow gained more than 23 points to end at 3,821. Advancing issues led declines by a margin of 2-1. This is NPR. Pregnant soldiers continue to serve the country, although they cannot be deployed during war. Army statistics show that 9% of the 20,000 women in U.S. combat units are pregnant. Soldiers are excused from marching, overnight field assignments, and overseas deployment while they're pregnant. They receive time off for doctor's appointments and 6 weeks of paid maternity leave. Critics say pregnant women in the Army raise health care costs, slow down the troops, and weaken the military's warrior spirit. The Pentagon says women make good soldiers even though they receive time off for pregnancy. The crew of the space shuttle Endeavour is spending its last full day in space. Dave Pignanelli of member station WMFE reports.
Tomorrow's scheduled landing will close out an 11-day mission where astronauts gathered extensive information about the Earth below. Using a powerful imaging radar in the shuttle's cargo bay, the crew scanned deserts, jungles, and oceans looking for environmental change. The images will later be converted into three-dimensional maps accurate to within 18 feet. This radar space laboratory mission was originally scheduled to end today, and astronauts are making the most of their extra time in orbit. The radar laboratory was turned on once again, this time gathering data on the ocean currents near the Antarctic Circle and forests in North Carolina. Endeavour and its six crew members are scheduled to land at the Kennedy Space Center tomorrow morning at 11:36 Eastern Time. For National Public Radio, I'm Dave Pignanelli reporting.
It is slightly cheaper to gas up a vehicle. A biweekly survey of 10,000 gasoline stations finds that average gas prices were down a penny in the last 2 weeks. Prices have been dropping since August due to lower crude oil prices and seasonal demand. The survey says customers paid about $1.21 per gallon on Friday. Self-serve station prices ranged from about $1.14 to about $1.30 per gallon, depending on the grade of fuel that the customer selected. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Anne Sexton committed suicide in 1974. For some of her fans, her death added to her tragic mystique. My guest is the poet's daughter, Linda Gray Sexton. After writing several novels, she's written a new memoir about growing up with a mother who was an inspired poet, but mentally ill. As a young woman, Linda says she fled from her mother's dramatics and pain and couldn't bear to be around her. Now in her early 40s, 20 years after her mother's suicide, Linda says she's trying to get back to her mother. Her new memoir is called Searching for Mercy Street. I asked Linda to read a letter her mother wrote to her when Linda was a girl.
Dear Linda, I am in the middle of a flight to St. Louis to give a reading. I was reading a New Yorker story that made me think of my mother, and all alone in the seat, I whispered to her, "I know, Mother, I know." And I thought of you, someday flying somewhere all alone, and me dead perhaps, and you wishing to speak to me. And I want to speak back. Linda, maybe it won't be flying. Maybe it will be at your own kitchen table, drinking tea some afternoon when you are 40. Any time, I want to say back. First, I love you. Second, you never let me down. Third, I know I was there once. I, too, was 40, and with a dead mother whom I needed still. This is my message to the 40-year-old Linda. No matter what happens, you were always my bobolink, my special Linda Gray. Life is not easy. It is awfully lonely. I know that. Now you know it, too. Wherever you are, Linda, talking to me. But I've had a good life. I wrote unhappy, but I lived to the hilt. You too, Linda, live to the hilt, to the top. I love you, 40-year-old Linda, and I love what you do, what you feel, what you are. Be your own woman. Belong to those you love. Talk to my poems or talk to your heart. I'm in both if you need me. I lied, Linda. I did love my mother, and she loved me. She never held me, but I miss her so that I have to deny I ever loved her, or she me. Silly Anne. So there. Hugs and kisses. Mom.
Linda, when did your mother write that letter?
She wrote that letter when I was a teenager. I believe I was 16. And I received it, but I did not allow myself to really take it in, and I put it at the back of a drawer in a strong box that held all my most precious things, and I rediscovered it a month after her suicide.
And what did it mean to you then when you rediscovered it?
Well, initially, I had no memory of ever having seen it, And this story is the way I begin Searching for Mercy Street, telling the story of reaching out and finding it and at first being frightened by it and not knowing whether or not it was in fact a suicide note. And rereading it, realizing it was a letter I had received as a teenager. At the time my mother died, I was 21, so some years had passed, and that I had kind of blocked it from my mind, because in this letter she is already talking about a time when she'll be dead, and it's directed to me at 40 years old, and I was 21 at the time, and it seemed very far away and very frighteningly far away.
So what does the letter mean to you now, now that you're a little over 40?
Well, it's a very, it makes me sad. It's hard to read without crying. But it makes me feel very loved, and there's so much affirmation in the letter for who I am and what I do. And, you know, I always, in my mind, see my mother riding around in the sky writing this letter, because she was on an airplane to give a reading. And I just have this vision of her kind of watching over me up there. And I talk to her up there very often.
When you rediscovered this letter, forgetting that you had read it years before, you thought maybe it was her suicide note. I take it she never really left a suicide note.
No, she did not. And we were all sort of surprised, because as everyone who's read her poetry knows, you know, she spoke so frankly of so many personal and private things, and yet here is a woman who put her whole life into words, and then she left her life without a word. It was hard not to, you know, to accept that there was no final note.
Do you think it was maybe because she expected to be rescued?
No. I think that she meant business. She had always before, when she had attempted suicide, she had done it with overdoses of various medications. And the day that she killed herself, she shut herself in the garage and left the car running.
You know, I think many of your mother's fans identified with her madness and even identified with her suicide, much as many of Sylvia Plath's readers did. But I think her madness, her suicide, had such a different meaning for you as her daughter than it did for people who were looking at her life from a great distance.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you bring that up, because really one of my main motivations in writing the book was I had this tremendous desire to strip away the myth that surrounds her, her life as a poet. People, I think, particularly her fans, tend to see, you know, they envision her as a depressed person hunched over a typewriter with a whiskey bottle at her elbow, creating great art. And the truth of the matter was, when she was very depressed, she rarely wrote at all. And so the depression took an enormous toll on her life as an artist, as a woman, and particularly on our life as a family. And one of the points I wanted to make, that really depression was her enemy, not her muse.
You think some people might have almost romanticized your mother's depression, but because of her illness, she sometimes had to send you away as a child because she was too sick to take care of you. And then when you got a little bit older, there were times when she wanted you to be her mother. You would play a game called Playing Nine. How would that go?
How would the game go?
Yeah.
The game itself was usually on a Sunday morning. We would have gone to church. Joy and I would have gone to church with a neighbor, and Mother would still be in bed. Daddy liked to call her a pad rat because she really liked to sleep a lot. And we had a family joke that she went to St. Mattress every Sunday. But in any case, so I would come home and she'd want to cuddle, and so I'd climb in, and I was 9 at this time. And what she would do is slide down in the bed so that her head was on my chest. And then she would pretend she was the child and I was the mother. And she would slip back in time to her own childhood with her Nana, who was her most adored adult, the one she felt she could really rely on. And they used to, obviously, cuddle a lot. And this she found very comforting. But unfortunately for me, recreating this experience was very anxiety-provoking, because sometimes she'd want to do this for an hour or an hour and a half, and I would become frightened. No child at 9 wants to be the mother. You know, a 9-year-old child needs to be the child. So these were very, very painful memories and really traumatic ones, I think.
My guest is writer Linda Gray Sexton. Her new book is a memoir about life with her mother, the poet Anne Sexton. It's called Searching for Mercy Street. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air.
back with Linda Gray Sexton. Her new book is a memoir called Searching for Mercy Street, My Journey Back to My Mother, Anne Sexton.
So much of your professional life has been bound up with your mother, too, because you've edited several volumes of her poems, a collection of her letters. You found a biographer to write her story, and now you've written a memoir about growing up with your mother. Back when you were 21, I think it was, your mother asked you to be her literary executor, to handle her literary estate. How did you feel about that?
I was not pleased. I saw it as her attempt to draw me back in, and I had at that point, you know, moved out of my own and felt that I was somewhat independent, and I didn't want to get drawn back into her life and her work. I was trying so hard at that point to establish my own identity. So basically she appealed to my vanity. She said, "You're the only one who can do this." And I said, "Well, what about Maxine Kuhman, who was another poet and her best friend?" And she explained to me that there was a lot of value to having the literary executor be a family member, because if there were any crises that came up over deciding what should be published or what should go where, anything like that, a family member was better suited. So basically, I gave in. I extracted from her, you know, an agreement that I would be paid, because I saw that I would have to take time off from my own work. So that was kind of my way of drawing a line. You know, my reaction at the time was one of dismay, and yet on the other hand, a certain kind of exhilaration, because it gave me a role, you know, to play. And that was one of the things Mother was so good at, figuring out what your weak spot was.
There are many difficult decisions you've had to make over the years as the literary executor of your mother's estate. I imagine one of the most difficult was this. There were recordings of psychiatric sessions she had when she was in therapy in the 1960s, and you made the decision to release recordings and transcriptions of those sessions to your mother's biographer, Diane Middlebrook. Was that a difficult decision for you to make?
I don't think that it was difficult, although there was no decision that I took lightly. Mother herself had placed the tape recordings and the transcriptions of the tape recordings that were in her possession into the archive that she had indicated to me should go to a university library to be used for scholarly and biographical use, so that when further tape recordings became available via the doctor who had made the recordings, I simply followed suit with the rest of them. But I felt Mother herself made the decision.
Did she have a different standard of privacy than you did, or than the rest of the family did?
Yes. Not than I did, but certainly than the rest of the family did, and in fact, perhaps more than most of the public does. There's a wonderful line from a poem called "For John, Who Begs Me Not to Inquire Further," who was one of her first mentors and who was quite shocked. He was a poet, John Holmes. He was quite shocked at the revelations she was making in her poetry. And in this poem, she explains herself by saying, "At first it was private, then it was more than myself." And I think that is sort of a nifty way to explain what went through her mind. You know, her motto really was that a writer's job is to dig deep into painful things and then to hold those things up before society so that society can see itself better. And that is the way in which we transcend individual experience and do our job as writers at illuminating things. I think that for the rest of the family, it's hard. It's very difficult, in fact, because most people who are involved with public figures don't, and certainly my father didn't bargain on, you know, essentially having my mother become a famous poet and then having a variety of the personal details of their life revealed.
What was it like for you to learn about how your mother felt about you from listening to tapes that she recorded with her psychiatrist?
It was pretty devastating, because the material that's contained in those tapes, I had always prided myself on being my mother's favorite and her friend, because from the time that I was 9 on, she relied on me for many things. And yet, in the very beginning, when I was a baby, she resented me because she felt she couldn't take care of me. And there was a lot of really painful revelatory material in some of this, some of these tape recordings and transcriptions, and even correspondence back and forth with the psychiatrist. And I had to go through all of that. Of course, it was part of my job as literary executor. It's part of what I'd said I would do.
Give us an example of something that you learned from the tapes that shocked you.
Well, when I was very little, my sister, I had gone back and forth many times to my grandmother's homes when my mother was too ill to take care of me, and my sister stayed at my grandmother's home for quite some time. And there were, you know, many times where she would just sit me in front of a television set while she was, mother would, sit me in front of a television set while she was typing away, or she talked a lot about hitting me and hating me because I was interrupting her, and she just, all she wanted to do was write because writing was the only thing that made her feel not crazy. That was really tough, you know, that kind of thing is, you want to know that your parents love you. And I know intellectually that it was her sickness, but when I was reading those things, I felt almost as if I were being hit again.
Mm-hmm. We've talked a little bit about your mother's illness and the problems that caused in your relationship. What were some of the special things about having such a gifted woman as your mother? Did she often show you her writing, and were you excited by her writing and by her sharing it with you?
Oh, it was the most magical part of the relationship. As I got to be a teenager, or even 11, 12, I would come home after school, and she would have been, of course, working during the day, and she would sit with me at the kitchen table, and we would drink tea and talk about her poems. And then as time went on and I began to write poetry too, we would share them back and forth. And what was so wonderful about her is that she never made me feel stupid when I didn't understand something. She took what I said very seriously, and that enabled me really to grow as a listener and as a reader. So that was a really enormous gift.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Linda Gray Sexton's new memoir is called Searching for Mercy Street, My Journey Back to My Mother, Ann Sexton. This is Fresh Air. Iraq has said it will move its troops away from the Kuwaiti border. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what will you have on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. We'll have a report from the Pentagon about the announcement that the troops will be pulled back, in effect lessening the provocation near the Iraqi-Kuwait border. We'll have the Pentagon's view of that, plus analysis and a discussion of what options remain open now for the Clinton White House. Richard Harris has a report on today's Nobel Prize announcement for medicine. Two Americans are winning that prize. I'll talk with Alberto Salazar, a three-time winner of the New York City Marathon, about Fred Lebow, who started that race back in 1970. Mr. Lebow died yesterday of brain cancer at age 62. Also on Columbus Day, some other celebrations.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. As a result of computer technology, reference books aren't what they used to be. Many of those big, heavy volumes that would build our biceps are available on discs light enough to pick up with our pinkies. But linguist Jeff Nunberg says it's not time to throw all those books out yet.
I've made this deal with myself about novels the way some people make deals with themselves about cigars or ice cream. English language novels are strictly rationed, but I can read as much as I want in foreign languages, provided I look up all the words I don't know and write them down in a little notebook. Except that when I read Flaubert, I don't have to look up the names of pieces of furniture. Over the years, the notebooks pile up in a drawer where I never open them because it makes me depressed to see how many times I've looked up the same words. But a deal is a deal. The one problem with all this is that a lot of the time I have available these days to read novels is when I'm on trains or airplanes, and it gets a little crowded trying to juggle a novel, a dictionary, a notebook, and the chicken supreme. Then last year, I bought myself a little handheld electronic French-English dictionary called the French Professor. This is one of those gadgets that cries out to be described as handy-dandy. It's got about as many words as a paperback dictionary, and it has a four-line display, which is big enough to give definitions that are more than a word long. And it lets me make my own little personal word list so I can dispense with a pen and notebook as well. It's only a small step for mankind, but over the last year, it's kept a fair amount of chicken off my lap. And it's an indication of how thoroughly electronic technologies are changing that most hidebound of books, the dictionary. It's ripe for electronic conversion. After all, this isn't a book most people take to bed with them. There are already several full-size college dictionaries you can put online on your PC or workstation, which make looking for a word a lot quicker and more convenient. And for serious word lovers, there's the Oxford English Dictionary on CD-ROM. Easier on the eyes than the small type version, easier on the back than the multi-volume folio set. Soon there will be dictionaries that can vary their definitions according to the interest of the user. And there will be multimedia definitions for words that are hard to define in print. For example, the print dictionary on my desk defines tango as a ballroom dance of Latin American origin in 2/4 time with a basic pattern of step, 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 close. That leaves rather too much to the imagination. The technology is already paying off in dictionary compilation. Dictionary making has always required an enormous amount of menial labor. The first edition of the Oxford English Dictionary took over 60 years to prepare. It was a classic exercise in loopy Victorian excess. Hundreds of volunteer readers combed over the whole of English literature. They recorded the uses of every word on millions of slips of paper that had to be organized and compiled. But now there's enough text in electronic form so that lexicographers can automate the process. The British are putting together a 100 million word corpus called the Bank of English, and the French have digitized a huge database of the historical records of their language. Systems comb over the corpus, classifying each word according to part of speech and a rough estimate of its meaning. For the time being, we still need human lexicographers to weed out the results, but people have already begun to talk about the prospect of a self-maintaining dictionary which monitors the language as it passes over the net and automatically records new words and new meanings. And yet, the old print dictionary still has its uses, even in the electronic age. A while ago, I got into an argument with a colleague who kept insisting that there was a word restrainment. I showed him that it wasn't in the electronic dictionary in my computer, but he wasn't convinced. How many words are in that thing, anyway? So I held up the big print dictionary that was sitting next to my workstation. I said, look, the dictionary on the computer is the same as this. And then he said, oh, well, in that case, I guess it isn't a word. And then I set the dictionary back down on the desk with a resounding, very physical thump.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at Stanford University and the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Roberta Shurrock, with Kathy Wolf and Barbara Bogave. Research assistance from Becky Cohn. Sienna Chrisman is our intern. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the results of a new survey on the sex lives of Americans. We'll hear from sociologist John Gagnon on what we do in bed, how often, with how many partners, and how society shapes our most private sexual experiences. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.